Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
I would assume that not everyone in the room is familiar with the National Coat of Arms that we see on this slide. Guesses? No. It is, however, one that encapsulates well the theme of my lecture, and I think the gravity of the issues that I tend to address. The golden snow leopard is a symbolic animal associated with the Alani, the Alans, a steppe federation that, along with Suevi and Vandals, entered Europe in the 5th century and established short-lived polities across Western Eurasia between the 5th and the 10th centuries of this era. Now, one might have thought that the Alans had disappeared over a millennium ago, but recently, historians and philologists, eager to prove both historical depth and national pride to some of the tiny linguistic communities in the Caucasus region, made the revelation that the Alans live on. They are, in fact, the Ossetians, and the image that you see is the official arms of the Autonomous Republic of North Ossetia. In the Caucasus, two communities speaking an Iranian language, the Irons and the Digars, are collectively called, in the Georgian language, Osseti, which the Russian has picked up to make the Ossetians. Beginning in 1980s, these two groups began to look for a common name. Well, Iristan from Iron was suggested, since this is the name for Ossetia in Ossetian, but the Digars objected that this slighted them, in part because the Irons are Christian, while many of the Digars are Muslim. Instead, they began to demand that Digar be recognized as a separate language and its speakers be allowed to form a separate nation-state. The growing tensions between the two groups resolved when a philologist began to assert that actually the Ossetians, both Digars and Irons, were actually Alans. The Ossetian historian Goodenough agreed, arguing that, quote, the Alan people had finally formed in the 8th to 10th centuries, and that he identified the Alans with the Ossetians without any reservation at all. For him, quote, our ancestors as a people had formed within the Alan state, and he viewed this as a strong argument in favor of replacing the name of Ossetians with that of Alans. Such a claim grew in popularity, fueled by both the desire to increase Digar-Iron unity and the desire to unite northern and southern Ossetia, and in part to justify territorial claims and disputes with their Caucasus neighbors, especially the Ingush to the northeast, that are yet another group, the conflicts that broke out in violence in 1991. At this point, the Supreme Soviet of North Ossetian Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic adopted a new flag with bands of white, red, and yellow, supposedly representing the Alan society's ancient division into three castes, priests, warriors, and commoners. By 1994, our historian Guriev was publicly calling for the state to, quote, give back the historic name of the Alans to the Ossetian people. And he, along with 20 other intellectuals, signed the, quote, Declaration of the Creative and Academic Intelligentsia of Northern Ossetia, demanding that the republic should be called North Alania and their language Alan. Ultimately, the name of the republic was changed to what it is today in its official title, the Republic of North Ossetia Alania. And its national emblem was changed to the Alan Golden Snow Leopard, in front of the Silver Mountains. Now, this all sounds rather specious, but we know the consequences of the demands of Ossetian Alanic self-identity and self-governance, particularly in South Ossetia, the region that was the center of terrible violence in Georgia just a couple of years ago. This example of the revival, not to say the invention, of a long-forgotten medieval ethnicity, along with its political, cultural, and territorial ramifications, is simply one example of the way that the search for a new beginning in Europe, both East and West, since 1989, has taken a complex and, I think, in some ways, surprising turn. Many technocrats, economists, and political scientists had anticipated that the dissolution of the Soviet Empire and its Warsaw Pact would generate primarily problems of economic integration, social dislocation, political restructuring, but these would be essentially forward-looking, focusing on models developed in the West during the last 50 years and concentrating on the integration into transnational European Union. Rather, to an extraordinary extent, the creation of new states in East and Central Europe and accompanying difficulties that these struggling polities have faced have generated a powerful nostalgia for a distant past and have returned to prominence old myths of medieval national origins and ethnic enmity. Nor is this politically potent nostalgia unique to the East. It's very easy to beat up on the Ossetians. Concerns about immigration, and especially the growing presence of Islamic communities, has rekindled interest in these old myths in Western Europe as well. Consider the case of France, where the medieval past is regularly invoked by Jean-Marie Le Pen, founder of that country's third largest political party, which continues today to be a very real presence in France. Le Pen announces that the French people were born with the baptism of Clovis in 496 and have carried this inextinguishable flame, which is the soul of a people, for almost 1,500 years. Well, the implication is clear. Those not baptized with Clovis, that is, Muslims and Jews, cannot be part of the French people born with the baptism of Clovis. Now, of course, not all Europeans are succumbing to the lure of these kinds of ancient ethnic nationalisms. There's a powerful countercurrent calling for a new European identity to replace these particular national and subnational identities that have formed the ideological basis of much hostility and violence over the past two centuries. And yet, I'm going to try to suggest this evening that even these seemingly progressive efforts often employ the same troubling tendency to ground modern identity in myths of the past, efforts that may carry their own risks as well. Now, I do this from my own perspective, which is that of an historian, as you've heard, of medieval Europe, who has long studied particularly the transformation of the Roman world, the end of antiquity, and the emergence of a Europe of nations, sometime between the 4th and the 10th centuries of the first millennium. I find this playing with medieval history, whether by traditional nationalists and sub-regional nationalists, or by the new Europeanists, quite troubling for a number of reasons. And I find that they share certain characteristics. The most conspicuous is a recourse to arguments based on a distorted but deeply held misapprehension of European history, and in particular on the history of the very period that is my area of study. This is, of course, not by any means a new phenomenon. Characterized 19th century nationalist ideology, but it's no less dangerous now than it was then. In the 19th century, historically based arguments about nationhood were equally seductive to peoples in search of states and to states in search of peoples. The classic examples are France and Germany. Germany, not politically united, sought a state to embody and extend the unique identity of what was seen as a German people. France had a long tradition of state continuity, but in the period after the French Revolution, tried to look to history to find a people whom the restored French state could embody. In between these poles were numerous interest groups, we'll call them, Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, Czechs, Basques, Britons, Magyars, and others that wanted proof that they too had the right to sovereignty, a right based in no small part on the historical claims to the past. And medievalists, my professional predecessors, provided what they needed by applying a mixture of Indo-European philology and Romantic nationalist history to the identification and the study of the deep pasts of aspiring peoples. German scholars led the way using German philology, the study of German language and languages, to project the existence of a Germanic people, recognizable in a common language, way into antiquity, even while their political colleagues were calling into existence in the present a German state. By applying rules of philology and claiming that people are defined by language and claiming that languages carry not only a way of speaking but a whole social structure and way in a culture, then this kind of search of people by language, aided by so-called scientific history, created not only German history but became a very potent tool for the creation of all history. They were a readily exportable package, easily applied to any corpus of text in any language. Nations and wannabe nations employed these tools in their own apparatus of national self-creation, including a corpus of the monuments of national history, while philologists, many of them educated in Germany, began to create a corpus of their national texts to show the ancient origins of their nation by tracing their languages back to their first appearance, secure in the knowledge that a people was defined by its language, and those who shared a common language shared a common culture and a common worldview. This philologically based scientific history, drafted into the service of nationalism, led back to the period of the 3rd and 11th centuries. Here was to be found the moment of primary acquisition, when the ancestors of modern nations, speaking their national language, which carried and expressed certain specific cultural and intellectual modes, first appeared in Europe, conquering for once and for all their sacred and immutable territories, and often in so doing, establishing for once and for all their natural enemies. Essentially, in such a vision was its almost genetic nature. Ethnic identity and thus national identity was an objective fact, an accident from birth, which one could only accept with its implications of friends, enemies, ancient territories, and the like. After the Second World War, this public role of medievalists largely disappeared. Popular interest in the Middle Ages moved toward the realms of fantasy and escapism, while questions of economic interdependency, modern technology, European unity seemed about to make these old historical appeals to nationalism absolutely irrelevant. Nobody thought that this was going to be an issue in the 1980s in Europe. The question was the euro and the increasing concentration of Europeans into originally the European Common Market and the European Union. We were told that nations were not so much recovered as called into being by 19th century intellectuals and politicians, that cherished images of the Alanic origins of the Ossetians or the importance of the baptism of Clovis for the birth of France were invented traditions. The past, in other words, doesn't matter. Well, scholars may scoff, and sociologists may scoff, but Europe's population remains strongly attached to its relationship with history, and in particular to traditions of identity based in the past. East and West, populist ideologies have found it convenient to return to prominence old myths of medieval national origins and ancient cultural traditions. And all of these share certain common characteristics. They look to the medieval past and attempt to discover there not just origins of peoples, but essences. Their claim is that this distant past somehow establishes specific rights in the present and the future, that moment of primary acquisition before which all claims were erased and after which no change mattered. Now, largely as a reaction to this nationalist instrumentalization of the medieval past, a new generation of scholars and politicians have begun doing just the opposite. That is, looking to their imaginative constructions of the medieval past, but to justify not ancient antagonisms, but rather Europeans' unity. Let's consider a couple of these. Simple one, Visegrad, a castle on the Danube, very nice tourist site. Czech, Slovak, Polish, and Hungarian politicians have drawn on the memory or the discovered memory of a 14th century treaty between Bohemia and Poland signed at the Hungarian Royal Palace of Visegrad as an inspiration of the so-called Visegrad Nations, an organization of these countries reminding the present and the past of their great and glorious friendship that was formalized in the Visegrad Pact. Well, never mind that the Czechs and the Slovaks, who fairly recently had a rather messy divorce, or that the Slovaks and the Hungarians have smoldering grievances that reach back to the old Habsburg Empire and its dismemberment. Historians, archaeologists, politicians, and Hungarian tourist promoters want Visegrad to be declared a World Heritage Site because of the importance of this proof of their unity and their brotherhood through the ages. And of course, this would help bring in tourists. So they want to use a 14th century treaty to advance 21st century politics of friendship and fraternity. Well, that's very nice, but it's a rather odd kind of history. And moreover, there's another Visegrad where something quite similar is going on. In this Visegrad, in eastern Bosnia, they've had more success. The Mehmet Pasha Sokolovic Bridge, built in the 16th century, became Bosnia's second World Heritage Site. Hungarians couldn't get it, the Bosniaks did. Its cultural value, I'm quoting the director of UNESCO, transcends both national and cultural borders. In other words, this is a symbol of the unity of Muslims and Christians, of Ottoman Turks and Serbs. He was saying this at the dedication of the bridge, but it was not held in Visegrad. The ceremony to dedicate the bridge and this UNESCO cultural site was held in Sarajevo because Visegrad was the site of the slaughter of some 3,000 Muslims by Bosnian Serbs. The area is now inhabited entirely by Serbs and is considered too dangerous for the director of UNESCO to visit at the time of the dedication. Apparently, the transcendence of national and cultural borders is not quite what it was said to be in the present and probably wasn't in the past. Now, beyond these spectacular, if localized, attempts to manipulate the past in order to heal the divisions of Europe are even more ambitious educational, scientific, cultural projects that Europeans are funding to build a European identity in place of national identities. There are programs sponsored by the European Science Foundation, the European Union, and other groups within Europe to support European-wide collaborative research aimed to reconcile differing and potentially explosive visions of the past and to create a sense of the unity of European experience. Well, that's very nice. But as an historian who's very skeptical about nationalist manipulation of the past, of the way that nationalists and subnational groups try to ground contemporary and future programs in the past, I'm very suspicious about progressive movements trying to ground the present and the future in a European past and a myth of European unity. Is it permissible, while rejecting history as a tool of nationalist particularism, to be just as willing as the nationalists to use history as a tool for European integration? I'm particularly concerned because many of these attempts by various groups to create a common European identity employ many of the same techniques as those of nationalist historians. First, once more, they look to the past, especially, but not exclusively, the Middle Ages, but to a great extent the Middle Ages, to identify the common essence of European identity. What is it that makes Europe Europe? And the answer has to be in the past, at some fixed moment of primary acquisition. Well, it's obviously not going to be language, unless think of English, which is the basic second language of Europe, but that would never work. So instead of language, one hears increasingly of a common faith, specifically Christianity, spread across Europe again between the 3rd and the 10th centuries. Such an approach conveniently ignores the often violent nature of the conversion of portions of Europe. It ignores centuries of deep conflict between Orthodox and Roman Christians, and even worse violence between Roman Catholic and Reformed Christians. It also ignores the continuing presence from before this period of non-Christians communities in Europe. And it ignores the fact that in the last 50 years, Christianity has largely disappeared from Europe, which is overwhelmingly secular. Second, there's a tacit assumption that this European culture, defined as Christendom, is static, once created, once and for all in the distant past, and like these ideas of primary acquisition, assumes that once this common heritage was in place, then nothing can or should change it. In a sense, this isn't history at all. This history, claimed as an all-important factor of the formation of Europe, is arguing that history is at an end, that all the changes ended, and now Europe is there. The new common European identity based on Christianity, Latin or Orthodox, a common culture, Renaissance Enlightenment perhaps, has now reached a steady state. History is over. Those who want to participate in this Europe must become European by adopting this identity. The identity itself will not undergo change as a result of new people coming into Europe or internal transformations of Europe. And already we're seeing the potential problems of this new way of writing the past and divining the future. There is a danger that European may be defined as a new nation, a new ethnic group, a new people, to be essentialized and then to be opposed to the non-European other. The boundaries of Europe are defined both externally and internally as the boundaries of contemporary Christendom. Turkey is not Europe, says the sign. And why is Turkey not Europe? It's not because of its geography. It's not because of its complexity in the history of the West. It is not Europe because of its religious identity. And within Europe, countries that have prided themselves on their openness to refugees from around the world and have done wonderful things for refugees, nevertheless are preparing them for assimilation, but only on local terms. Immigrants from Eastern Europe and Scandinavia or the Low Countries, immigrants from North Africa or elsewhere in the world or South Asia, are welcome to become Danes or Swedes or Dutch. But by so doing, they must become that which the host country is. They are expected to adopt the cultural values of their new countries. The idea that their cultures, the cultures of Europe, might change as a result of these immigrants is seen as something to be faced with fear and massive opposition. The fear that Europe will become Eurabia, as has been recently title of a recent book, or that Europe, the European flag, must be understood as essentially Christian. Just as the 19th century nationalists evoked an eternal national identity, too many modern Europeanists are claiming an eternal European identity that everyone must adopt. I find this rather disturbing. Now, I'm not claiming that Turkey should immediately be admitted to the European Union, or that radical religious teachings of wetter stripes should be permitted in the name of political correctness. I do worry about the anxiety of certain Europeans about changing their skyline and allowing more than one kind of religious tower to stick above their cities. I'm concerned about basing these ideas of what constitutes Europe within a fundamental misunderstanding of what history is all about and what the history of Europe is all about. I think that rethinking the relationship between past and present needs to start with a rejection of the popular sociology of the modernists that argue that peoples and nations are just a 19th century invention. That clearly is not the case. Past societies had real identities. Real identities which, while multiple and overlapping, were meaningful to large portions of the society and could mobilize people for concerted action. But at the same time, we need to discard the idea that these were some sort of homogeneous, stable, linguistic, or cultural units. And this is an idea invented by the Greeks and the Romans to project it on barbarians. The strange thing is that Europeans decide they are barbarians and that the Romans are right about them. A very, very peculiar switch of an understanding. It's more appropriate to think of what our sources call peoples and what we see today as constitutional rather than biological groups or even cultural units. Membership in peoples is never simply a question of language, cultural heritage, or origins, but it's rather a question of those who participate, coming from different languages, different cultural and geographical origins, political traditions. They're programs rather than peoples, or parties, we might understand them, rather than biological peoples. Their names and their leaders, rallying points in shifting political and military alliances. And these identities have changed across history radically. What masqueraded as shared histories and common culture were claimed and claims could be programs manipulated by leaders in their efforts to garner support. Peoples change their religion. They even change their languages. They change their customs, and they keep the name. In other cases, the names change and political and cultural programs continue. As long as people are willing to work together, fight together, they can become members of these peoples without necessarily abandoning other, even conflicting identities, which can then reemerge at other times. This essential diversity is, of course, true of Christendom as well. From its inception, Christianity has been a collective noun that covers a multitude of ecclesiae, of communities, of churches, that differ often violently over fundamental issues of belief, practice, and organization. Islam, too, is enormously diverse, and stereotyping Muslims is no more realistic than the old stereotypes of Germans and French as goose-stepping Nazis or garlic-eating hedonists. Second, rather than searching the continuities linking migration period to the present in order to construct a new master narrative of the Europe of today, we should understand the essentially discontinuous nature of national identity. Groups change. They change what we think of as their essential characteristics. They change their language, their religion, their modes of warfare, their customs, even their histories. They can move easily because they are heterogeneous, so they can absorb and choose explicit ideologies while recruiting people from without. Medieval Goths could become Huns, then become Goths again. Romans could become barbarians, and barbarians could become Romans. Franks, the ancestors of the French and the German, could abandon their language and their religion for Latin and Christianity, but somehow stay Franks. Shared legends of origins can be contradictory and live quite happily together. And religion has likewise been not a constant in European history. It has changed radically in the past two millennia, as have Europeans' attitudes toward it as a common heritage. Significant numbers of non-Christians, particularly Jews, but also Muslims and polytheists, have always existed within Europe. Nor has religious toleration been characteristic of European culture until extremely recent times. I remember in the 1960s a Spanish prelate saying tolerance is just a sign of weak faith. Remember that in the 13th century, most European nations assumed that the existence of Jews in Christian Europe was intolerable and expelled Jews from their populations. Similar, in the 16th and 17th century, Catholics and Protestants fought bloody wars across Europe, absolutely convinced on both sides that Christian confessional unity was absolutely essential to the survival of a state, of a people. Today, it's hard to imagine those kinds of conflicts, and yet we are told that Islam is fundamentally, eternally incompatible with Europe. Are we going to see this any differently than Catholics and Protestants or Christians and Jews when looking at it in a few centuries? And finally, and most importantly, I think the process of identity formation, what it is to be a European, and it does mean something to be a European. This is not another just an invention. It means something. But it didn't end with the barbarian migrations. It did not end with Christianity. We do not replace primary acquisition with primary conversion. European peoples continue to be works in progress. New European peoples will appear. Old ones transform, new supranational identities emerge with new characteristics, drawing on immigrant culture as much as on the complexities and unresolved contradictions in contemporary culture. And this really is what history is all about, and this is why fundamentally I object so much to this digging into the well of history for the present. History is the study of change over time. Europe has not ended history. Europe is changing. It will change. Whatever Germany and France or the European Union are today, it's not what they were a decade ago. It's not what they were a century ago. And it is not, certainly, what it is going to be tomorrow. History is not something in the past that people like me study. It's the world in which we all have to live. Thank you.
Our thanks to Patrick Geary, for a distinguished professor of medieval history at UCLA, for his comments here today. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Professor Geary, we have some questions, so let's begin. The first one is, what are your thoughts on the best EU immigration policy, and what should the limits and enforcement be?
I'm not an EU officer in charge of immigration, so I'm not going to give you a policy statement. I think that European immigration policy has clearly been deeply flawed since World War II, and there are certainly very important changes that have to be made. I think that the desire to bring cheap labor into Europe during the post-war reconstruction resulted in catastrophes in much of Europe, certainly in Germany, certainly in France, and certainly in Belgium. The willingness to take refugees into Scandinavia has also created serious problems. I think that immigration has to be controlled. I do not believe in open borders. I think that people who are immigrating into Europe have to be able to find a place in society, but also to create a space for themselves in that society. I think that it is important that people of different religions, of different cultural traditions, be allowed to watch those cultures change and transform as their own in new situations. This is why I'm very nervous about arguments that one has to live European to be European, or that one has to abandon one's very strong beliefs and cultural traditions to be part of Europe. So I want tighter border controls. I want to see European reaching into those areas of immigration to help improve the economic circumstances that send desperate people from Africa and elsewhere at great peril into ships trying to get to Europe. They're often fleeing disastrous economic and political circumstances that the West has created. So we need to deal with these problems at home and not just build higher walls. And for those immigrants who are in Europe, I think that Europeans have to realize that Europe is not going to be the same with a 10 or 15% Muslim population, and that's maybe a good thing. Islam will change as well as Christianity will change. And I think that if we deny either of those, then we're kidding ourselves and we're in for continued alienation and trouble.
Thank you. Another question I have here is, how did the Nazis draw on medieval history to justify their actions?
It's a very mixed and bizarre combination. Nazi intellectuals, those who were at the forefront, were not particularly clever. There's a combination of medieval ideology. You've probably seen the picture of Adolf Hitler as a knight, a famous painting. There is an ideology of the medieval German expansion to the east that takes place from the 10th to the 14th century, which is justifying the expansion of Germany toward the east, so that there is a claim to be returning to this. But then there's also drawing on very early Germanic traditions, ideas, very strange ideas, that because barbarian people started out from Poland, what is now Poland, and immigrated in the great wandering of peoples, the Völkerwanderung, that actually conquering Poland was just going back home. But it's this combination of pre-Christian paganism, because fascism, the Nazi ideology is very anti-Christian. So it's pre-Christian paganism with a strange mix of chivalric ideas of the German opposed to the Slav. So it's a real mishmash within German ideology, but they certainly will pull on these ideas. And sadly, many, many medievalists were delighted with this kind of ideology. As one of my German friends says, medieval German history was really not much deflected during the Nazi period because they were already going in that direction, particularly in terms of East and West. The German attitude toward the Slavic world, which is one of the major areas of preoccupation in the 30s, was very much part of an intellectual tradition, very much organized and is supported by professional historians, some of whom rose to very high positions in the Nazi Party and in the administration of some of the occupied territories in the East. But ideologically, it's a real mishmash.
Thank you. Another question we have is, will Balkanization occur in Western Europe? Will the Scots, Welsh, Northern Italians, etc., become independent within the EU?
Well, that's
the Basques too. That was the other nationality.
It's a very good question, and I think the way the question is phrased is very significant. Will they become independent within the EU? Is there any independence in the EU? Well, I think it's fascinating that Belgium, for a period of over 6 months, had no government. They had no government, but they didn't collapse. Now, 150 years ago, that could not happen because without an army for protection, without a currency, without infrastructure, they would have been eaten up by their neighbors. Their economy would have collapsed. Their communities would have disintegrated. You don't need a government anymore in Europe because no one is independent. So why shouldn't the Scots have their parliament? They don't really control things any more than the British do, or the Flemish, or the Basques. So there's all this kind of micro-nationalism. Some of it can be very ugly. The Basques can be extremely vicious to the killing Spanish, just as we've seen in Northern Ireland. But these are fights about things that in a certain sense don't matter because within Europe, these are kinds of luxuries you can afford. Belgium probably is going to split. We're probably going to have Flanders, an economically more prosperous area, very powerful kind of ethnic ideological movements, this Flemish Folks Party. Turkey is not Europe. There's a very strong racist component to it. I don't know whether they hurt Turks or Walloons more. They're probably going to break apart, but that probably won't matter because they're not seceding for the European Union. So paradoxically, the stronger the union, then the more these little groups can claim their own identity. Will they actually get to the point of violence? Is it worth fighting to get your own flag? Then you want to be at the UN and you will want Basque as a language to be spoken in the European Union deliberations, and you will certainly want the economic subsidies and so forth that everyone else gets. So it's not fighting for independence. Don't think of Europe splintering into micro-nations of the 19th century sort. It's a much more limited kind of thing, and I think that there's a certain extravagance and not playfulness, because it can be very ugly and very violent, but they're fighting about things that are not going to terribly affect how they live. And this is one of the peculiar realities. Catalonia is a much more interesting area. Here we have really largely separate existence within the Iberian Peninsula, within Spain. That's fine. They're doing fine. It doesn't really hurt Madrid that Barcelona is the place that all the young people want to go on holidays. It's an economically viable place. They have their own language. They have their own culture. They have their own schools. It's not a problem. If the European Union didn't exist, it would be a major problem. And the same is true across Europe. What about the Free East Anglia movement? Or will Picardy secede from France? What about Normandy or Alsace-Lorraine? This is not likely. So will Corsica get free of France? I don't think they'll want to get free of Europe if they get free of France. I don't know if that really answers the question, but I see Europe protects this, and the Flemish have a better chance and the Scots have a better chance dealing in Brussels than, the Flemish have a better chance with the EU in Brussels than they do with the Walloons in Brussels. The Scots have a better chance in Brussels than they do in London. So we're going to work out new connections, or maybe some old ones that will come back. Bavaria and northern Italy have always had a lot in common. They may find new ways of having relations rather than to Berlin and to Rome. I think that's fine. I don't think that it really matters within European Union.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Modern European Nationalism and the Fight to Control the Past with Patrick Geary, Professor of Medieval History at UCLA. Our next question, again, is talking about ethnic identities. European federalists promote a federal system with ethnic identity at different levels, as in Bavaria, Germany, and Europe. What are your views on this?
I think that this is probably a healthy project. I don't think it's the only project. It's very interesting that you had mentioned Germany. Of course, it is a federal republic. And so Germany, with a very short history of being a nation state, naturally thinks in those terms. And there are other members of the European Union, such as France, that don't think in those terms because they have a different history. Now, their histories are changing. France is moving toward increasing attempts at divesting central power with creation of regions that actually have some authority, trying to move institutions out into regions. So there is a regionalization going on within the nation states that comprise the European Union. And I think that this is probably a very healthy, natural development. What that will lead to, I don't know, because, again, no one is independent anymore. They are interdependent, and that interdependency operates at all levels. Now, if people start demanding that their languages be used for all EU documents, this gets complicated because just in the 19th century, how many languages are there? What's the difference between a language and a dialect? Well, a language is a way of speaking that also has a national army and a flag. And a dialect doesn't have an army and a flag. Well, this can get very complicated. Will Occitan be one of the recognized languages in the European Union? Well, Occitan, but what about Franco-Provençal? And what kind of Occitan, the dialects of Toulouse, or would it be the dialects of perhaps Agen? So this can lead to impossible complications. But general regionalism within Europe, as the nation's central authority becomes less significant, then regional identities and actual functioning regional networks can reemerge. Remember, Europe didn't look like what it does today. For a long time, our maps of France and Germany, the period I studied, they don't exist at all. So there's nothing eternal about the hexagon or about Germany. Germany has been, you know, Germany over, überall is all over the place in that sense. So what these places are going to shift and change, that's part of history, that's part of life.
What about the millions of Russians living outside the Russian Federation, the Ukraine, the Baltics, and Central Asia? Won't Russia one day want to bring these Russians back into the Federation?
This is an enormously explosive issue and one that our country has not done a very good job of dealing with. In some cases, these new republics have made efforts to give not only theoretical but real citizenship to all of the inhabitants of their territory. In others, it is seen as payback time. And the Russian minorities, and in some cases they're close to majorities, are essentially disenfranchised and are second-class citizens, if even citizens. This is a tremendous problem and one that the U.S. and NATO have not paid sufficient attention to. We see what's going on right now in Ukraine. Eastern Ukraine, overwhelmingly Russian. Crimea, almost entirely Russian. The home port of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. This is a major Russian community. Western Ukraine, Ukrainian. Different history, different past, much more connected to the old Greater Grand Duchy of Lithuania, to the Habsburg world, a world that is very, very different in many ways, and yet imposing a Ukrainian identity as understood in Lviv on this large population, because these people aren't real Ukrainians, because they just came here in the last 100 or 200 years, or even in the 20th century or the 19th century. This is like saying that the Moroccans or Algerians can't be real French because they only came to France in the 1950s. The exclusion of these people from participation in their countries and having a voice in their countries is extremely dangerous. We have seen this blow up in the face of the Georgians. There's no reason, there are politicians in Ukraine who would love it to blow up. And if we look to countries like Estonia, we see terrible problems. If you do not speak Estonian, you do not have full Estonian citizenship. There are terrible problems here. And yes, these people's families came through the history of the Soviet Empire. Well, that's history. I'm sorry. Peoples move. And they always have, and they always will. And to say we're going to expel them as foreign elements, or we're going to deny them access to what we think of as the rights of citizens, simply makes no sense. It's exactly the same situation in an earlier period with the Hungarian population. You know, Hungary in the Trianon Treaty lost roughly 50% of its population and 50% of its territory to its neighbors. And these Magyar minorities, and in some cases regional majorities, in Slovakia, in Romania, in Ukraine, in Serbia, Slovenia, in those places where they are denied political rights, systematically treated as second-class citizens or as foreign elements, this is an eternal problem. And those areas where it's not an issue, where they are citizens of their country who speak a different language, these things work their way out in time because these communities will change and evolve. But if they're isolated, isolate the Russian populations, bar them from full participation, they'll change all right, but those changes will be the changes of internally increasingly angry groups. And Mother Russia will, of course, be concerned about them, just as Mother Hungary has been concerned about the Magyar minorities. According to the Hungarian Constitution, Hungary has a responsibility for all Hungarians wherever they live in the world, which presumably means New Brunswick, New Jersey as well. Currently, we're not badly treating our Hungarian minority, as far as I know, so it's not an issue. But if we do, we'd better watch out for Budapest.
And how do the Roma fit into a national or European identity? And when did they arrive in Europe?
When Adolf Eichmann was on trial in Jerusalem, he said, you know, we went after the mentally defective, but people complained. And we went after the Jews, and people complained. And we went after the Roma, and nobody complained. This is truly the population in Europe that has suffered the most certainly in the 20th century, a population that has been universally despised, a population that begins appearing in Europe toward the end of the Middle Ages. a population that is essentially a nomadic population that operates at certain kinds of trade, craft and trade operations. It fills a niche. This is not unique in the world. We think that people and places go together. That's a very modern ideal. Stratification of peoples can be geographic. It can also be occupational. It can be urban and rural. And in traditional Europe, the Roma population may not have been particularly appreciated, but they had a role. They were traveling salespeople. They bought and sold horses. They played various roles within peasant societies that needed tinsmiths, handymen, various sorts of operations. Within an industrialized world, they have never fit into this world. The Soviets and the socialist republics really tried. I would say they tried in many cases more than post-Soviet democracies have tried to find an accommodation for these populations. But they are a people without a territory and largely without a history. The cultivation of history, by all that I understand, is not an important issue within this kind of society. And this is becoming an increasing area of anxiety, first of all, in Romania and Hungary. And the birth rate in Hungary, like the birth rate in most of Europe, is collapsing, except for the Roma population. So I often hear in Budapest, and particularly in eastern Hungary, well, we'd better learn Roma because pretty soon they're going to be the majority. There's a great anxiety about the Roma population. And then the Roma population moving into other parts of Europe. One of the great problems is the nature of the society that simply does not fit into a industrial, let alone a post-industrial cultural tradition. And there are organizations working with Roma. There are dedicated people in Central Europe as well as in the European Union who are trying to work with these minorities. But the prejudice against Roma in Europe is enormous. And any of you who have spent time in Central and Eastern Europe, we've talked with people, will hear these kinds of stories. And I'm from the Deep South. I'm from Louisiana. And I recognize the rhetoric. I'm not prejudiced, but. And the things, as Eichmann said, when we went for the Roma, nobody objected.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for only one last question. You focused on Europe today, but this question wants to relate some of the concepts that you discussed to the United States. And specifically, they wanted to know if you perceive the creation of a number of Native American tribes, you know, based on historical facts, and the fact that there's giving them rights to establish a casino, you know, that their historical background seems to be the basis for being able to set up these separate entities.
Well, what I'm talking about is certainly not limited to Europe. It exists in other ways in other parts of the world. It certainly exists in the Middle East. It exists in Asia. And we have our own varieties here in which we make claims about the present based on how we construct the past. The issue of Native American rights based on the past. Casinos, that's not exactly based on history of ethnic groups, although who is a member of the tribe, which can be a question of blood percentages, which sounds rather remarkable in this modern of day and age of genetics. I also remember in Louisiana when to be black meant to be 1/64th black. Now, to be able to enjoy casino revenues, some percentages of Indian blood may be required. I think that this is very, very problematic. At the same time, I think it's wonderful to see these communities that are among the poorest in the country getting our money without having to do anything but set up casinos. On the one hand, I think that's pretty clever. It's payback in a way. But this question, as money matters, then this idea of blood and blood descent is an issue. And some would say, well, look, one has to accept this. Within the Native American population, there is an understanding of the world. And you have to allow that understanding of the world. At what point does that understanding of the world and other understandings of the world come into conflict? And what does this do to people who have lived and have been members of communities for generations? I think of the Black Seminoles who have now been expelled in some cases from communities, or other groups that are now seen as black and not Indian, whereas for over two centuries they were part of the community. Yes, this is very reminiscent of a kind of racial identification that even European nationalists of the fairly vigorous sort are not pursuing these days, as far as I can see. And I think that this is something that needs to be discussed, and perhaps you should invite a speaker more knowledgeable than I to take this head on. There's also the question of the recovery of antiquities. Is a skeletal find that is 10,000 years old the direct ancestor of a contemporary people, and therefore that people has the right to determine that paleontologists and physical anthropologists may not study those remains because that is a member of the family? Those are questions in which our understanding of history and genetics contradicts or comes into conflict with a different way of understanding the past. And we're trying now to work out how far can we go to accommodate other values? And these are issues that your organization might really think about having some interesting discussion on.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to Patrick Geary, Professor of Medieval History at UCLA, for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 107 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.